This is Susan Vabrock, Telluride Inside and Out. Beryl Bender Birch. Her history is the history of yoga in America, a story of assimilation and diversification, and now a story of big business as well. This spiritual teacher, yoga therapist, and author, you know some of her books, it's Power Yoga, Beyond Power Yoga, Yoga for Warriors, was an early adopter and pioneer in the early 1970s. This former student of English and philosophy at Syracuse University and biofeedback researcher became an avid student of yoga and the study of human consciousness. Beryl is the founder and director of the Hard and the Soft Yoga Institute that was established in 1980. She now teaches classical yoga all over the world, guiding and inspiring students of all levels with her down-to-earth style, including at the Telluride Yoga Festival, where the very popular instructor returns to teach classes in asana, meditation, pranayama, and yoga nidra. Beryl, thanks for taking time out of your schedule to join me.
Hi, Susan. Thank you so much for such a lovely introduction. And I am so looking forward to coming back to Telluride and seeing you and all the people that show up every year there. It's my favorite yoga festival, and it seems to be growing every year. I couldn't be happier. They do such a great job. So that's coming up. I'm leaving for Colorado in 2 weeks from today, so I'm getting excited.
Yes. So would you connect the dots between that degree that I referred to in English and philosophy to the study of classical yoga and human consciousness? Did your move from New York to California have anything or everything to do with that?
Oh my! Well, that's a provocative thought. That's a thought-provoking question. My sort of launch into English and philosophy was kind of it's the automatic response. I really wanted to be a theoretical physicist, and math and science just kicked my butt. And I was severely dyslexic, although I didn't figure it out until I was in my late 40s. I had no idea. And back when I was in school, that wasn't even a consideration. So I found out that when I could think logically and use my intuition, as in English and philosophy, I could get A's in classes. And so it was sort of the automatic path. But I loved philosophy. I took a lot of courses in comparative religion and loved that. So got out of school, moved to New York City. Oh, lived there for 5 or 6 years trying to be an actor. I spent 2 years of graduate school at the American Academy of Dramatic Arts, and then I decided I was going to move to the country. So I moved to L.A. in 1970.
And what happened there that sort of triggered your move to yoga and the study of consciousness?
Well, the pursuit of acting wasn't going too well. I was really good at all aspects of theater and acting, makeup, movement, Shakespeare, everything. I just couldn't act. And I was just terrorized when I would get on stage and I couldn't memorize. And so I got a job, ironically, at the Biofeedback Institute of Los Angeles, just initially as helping out in the office. And they were working on a study measuring the brainwave patterns of meditators, both of martial artists and Zen practitioners. So I became very involved in biofeedback, and along with Chyam Trungpa Rinpoche and my guru Munishri Chitrabanu, who is a Jain monk who came over to this country, and right around that time, 1970, I learned meditation and kind of dropped into it pretty heavily with the aid of biofeedback. It's fascinating. It was a fascinating study to me and a fascinating practice. And I started dabbling around taking my first asana classes. I took my first yoga class was with Yogi Bhajan, probably in 1971, the founder of Kundalini Yoga in this country. And I wasn't really inspired to become a devotee. I already had a teacher, so I took a few of those classes, did a lot of Iyengar classes with many of the senior Iyengar teachers. And then in 1975, I moved to Colorado because L.A. was smoggy and hot in the summertime, and I was depressed about that.
Okay, so that's a nice segue to my next question, which was your first job teaching yoga was in Winter Park. How did that come about?
Well, I was to live in Winter Park, Colorado, you had to be very creative and diverse in terms of your vocation. And I worked as a waitress and a bartender, and those were back in the days when all you had to make was whiskey sours and martinis and Manhattans. But I also started teaching yoga there. I'd been studying yoga for 3 or 4 years, and I started teaching. Actually, the first yoga I taught was the Shivananda yoga system with lots of Iyengar influence. So I taught all the skiers and all the ski instructors and all the lodge owners and all the bar owners, and pretty soon I taught everybody in the town. And by 1980, I had classes were going really well. It was great, and I decided, look, I'm either going to be stuck here forever, or I need to move back to a big city and get going on a career. And so, little did I realize I was already embarked on a career, but I decided to. First, I moved to Denver for a short period of time and then decided I might as well move back to New York. So I did.
Okay. Of the three lineages that emerged from the home of Krishnamacharya, arguably the father of yoga in the West, those lineages being Iyengar, Vinaya Yoga, and Ashtanga, why did you decide to study Ashtanga Vinyasa? You alluded to your previous studies of, for example, Iyengar. So why then was it the move to New York that got you to focus on Ashtanga?
It was meeting Norman Allen in 1979 in the city at a workshop. I was running a yoga teacher training program at the Jain Meditation International Center, which was the center, the organization started by my teacher, Chitra Banu. And I was teaching yoga there when I was in New York and started this teacher training program. And one of the students at the one of the meditation students at the center was studying with Norman Allen. And he had just come back from India. He'd been with Pitabi Joyce for 3 or 4 years and was the first Westerner to master all the series of the Ashtanga asana tradition. And I saw him do this workshop with I saw him work with two of his students. So those were all the students he had at the time. And I was just blown away. I went, oh, my God, this is yoga. I went all the way to India in 1974 to find God. And now here it is in my very backyard. So I was so inspired by watching him teach and practice that I said, I really want to learn to do this. And he said, you want to do this? Okay, here's the deal. 6 months minimum, 24 days a month, 5:30 in the morning. You miss a day, you're out. Yes or no, no pressure. And I was like, wow, you know, I just come from California where, you know, you try this and you try that and, you know, it was the epicenter of the human potential movement and people were experimenting with all kinds of ways to get high. And I went, okay, well, I haven't really learned discipline yet. Let me try this. And so I just fell in love with it, fell in love with Norman and the practice and was a really good student in terms of commitment and dedication and studied with him for several years until he moved to Hawaii.
Okay. Wow. So your name has, you know, sort of by extension, because Ashtanga is associated with power, your name is synonymous with power yoga. Is that a blessing or a curse? What does power yoga mean to you today versus when you coined the term back in the 80s? And please integrate that answer with the name of your institute, the Hard and the Soft Yoga Institute, which is a riff on the yoga paradox of Sutira Sukha.
Susan, that's a great topic to bring up. It was really both a curse and a blessing. When I first came up with the name, which was probably in the mid-80s sometime, it came to me in a meditation. The minute I started practicing Ashtanga, I began teaching it. I mean, not the same day, but, you know, within about 6 months, I just segued over from teaching the Shivananda style to teaching the Ashtanga asana practice. And it coincided with my return to New York. So when I started teaching at the Roadrunners Club, that's what I was teaching. And because I was doing it regularly and every day, and, you know, I moved through the series pretty quickly and was doing first and second series within about 6 months. But I was teaching to athletes, all of whom were tight and, you know, stiff and injured or getting injured or wanted to avoid injury, and it was impossible not to modify the practice and make, because I thought it was a fantastic practice, and I went, oh my God, this would be so great for athletes, because you get hot, you sweat, it's much safer to stretch when you're sweating. You know, I'd watch runners throw their leg up on the fence in Central Park in New York and try and bounce into a stretch, and, you know, I would make the hair on the back of my neck stand up. I'm going, oh my God, that isn't going to work. So when I first came up with the name, I was really proud of it. I thought it was brilliant. I went, this is perfect. One, it'll let Westerners know that yoga is a workout, because in the 70s, yoga was regarded as very soft and something women did and all about stretching. And then I thought, and it's also a name that Westerners can relate to, it will get more men into the classes. And I thought it was a great thing. Brian Kess came up with the name on the West Coast about the same time, and neither one of us was aware of the other one until a little farther down the road. We both tried to trademark it. He tried to trademark it, and we kind of stopped it because I actually used it first in commerce, and then I said, well, why don't you support my trademarking it, and I'll sell you the rights to it for a dollar. I don't want money. I just want us to be able to protect the name. Well, he just done all these videos with Warner Brothers, and they said, nope, we're not going for that. So we didn't trademark it, which, I don't know, maybe it's the way it was. So it seems like it must have been intended to be that way, because everybody and their brother started teaching power yoga, and it became very... there was no control over it. It could be whatever people wanted it to be. You know, it could be jumping jacks and a little stretching. It could be Brian Kess power yoga or Baron Baptiste power yoga or Mark Blanchard's power yoga. And so I went through a period when I was really horrified and embarrassed about being associated with the name. And then writing the book, which did phenomenally well and turned a lot of people onto yoga, many of whom went to study in India after that. It got me thrown out of the Ashtanga church, which in retrospect was a good thing, because I was never really inspired to become a devotee of Patabi Joyce. I was respectful. I was a good student, studied with him for several years. Because he was Norman's teacher, and I wasn't able to continue my studies with Norman. But I didn't really feel he was an enlightened master and wasn't, you know, it wasn't my path, obviously. And that didn't sit well with the whole hierarchy. So being a woman didn't help things either. So it was, you know, and now in retrospect, you know, it all played out the way it played out, and lots of people got turned on to yoga and because of my book. And that was my goal, was to make it accessible to more and more and more people.
And by it, you mean, I want to clarify this, it's super important for what you're teaching at the Telluride Yoga Festival. By it, you mean yoga in the fullest sense of a practice, namely asana, pranayama, self-study or svadhyaya, and chanting meditation.
Yeah, well, I kind of grew into that because when I, in the early 80s when I first started teaching asana, and it was, to me, it was all about asana. Norman is the one who turned me on to Ashtanga Yoga, the eight-limb path. I didn't make the connection between the meditation I had started doing since 1971 and the practice of asana until I got a copy of the Yoga Sutra, and which was given to me by Norman. And then I went, oh, I see how this works. And, yeah, so I teach Ashtanga Yoga, and I certainly can teach Mysore or Lead, the first and second series of Pattabhi Joyce's Ashtanga Asana system. But when I refer to Ashtanga, I am referring to the classical yoga, the eight-limb path. Iyengar was an Ashtanga yogi, but Swami Satchidananda was an Ashtanga yogi. Swami Shivananda was an Ashtanga yogi. All of them were students of classical yoga. So people forget that it goes way beyond asana, and I think it's important to define which Ashtanga you're talking about.
Yes.
And thank you for clarifying that.
So take that, travel with that idea to the name of your institute, the Hard and the Soft Yoga Institute.
That comes from, I'm sorry, did I interrupt you? Go ahead. Did you
want
to add to that question?
Yeah.
That comes from a Zen proverb which says, only when you can be extremely pliable and soft can you be extremely hard and strong. I discovered that in like the early 70s, or the late 70s, sorry, when I was still in Colorado, and I felt, wow, you know, that is really our whole lives, that it's always about right action, finding right action, as the Buddhists say, and how do we develop right action? That comes out of skillful means. And skillful means comes out of practice. And practice isn't just about doing your asana. It's about having a practice, about learning to pay attention 24/7, no matter what you're doing, chopping carrots, scooping dog poop, driving your kids to school, getting your attention in present time, which is what all yoga practices are about. They're training us, body and mind, to be here. And once you make an effort to be present, transformation begins to unfold. And it's really a pretty miraculous methodology. So for me, hard and soft, you know, is about, well, sometimes, you know, it's about tough love. Some of time it's about hanging on. Sometimes it's about standing your ground. And other times it's about, you know, support and letting go and surrendering and being soft and forgiving and cultivating loving kindness. So that balance between hard and soft is like the balance between truth and nonviolence, between satya and ahimsa. Truth without the balance of kindness can be a very cruel and hard weapon. Mm-hmm. And nonviolence without the balance of truth, it can get you run over. I mean, if you just, you know, are constantly worrying about being nonviolent, you know, people will begin to walk all over you. So you've got to know, I think we have to become skillful at learning, you know, when do you stand up and when do you step out of the way? I mean, some things are worth dying over, but not everything is.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. Thank you. Let's drill down to the Telluride Yoga Festival. Despite the fact that your schedule is insanely busy, you're doing yoga teacher trainings all over the country. You're going to do one in London. You just got back from Cuba. Why do you keep returning to Telluride? What's the draw?
I love Telluride. I lived in Colorado for, you know, almost 8 years. My dad was born in Colorado. I feel like I'm home when I'm there. It's an excuse to go to Colorado and visit friends in Denver and Boulder, and I love Telluride, and I'm so grateful they keep inviting me back. I went several years when they first started, and then I we had a break for a couple years, and then they began to ask me back again, and I'm just grateful to be a part of such a wonderful festival, and they do such a good job. I mean, yeah. It's Albert and Erica Albert, who is the director, and Erica, who is the co-director, are just so dedicated to this festival. So I just love it.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's drill down even further to the classes you're going to teach. In order, they are pranayama, asana, meditation, and yoga nidra. Would you, as you're talking about the classes, clarify the difference between meditation and yoga nidra? They're often confused.
Oh, yeah. Well, you're right. They are. And certainly yoga nidra is a type of meditation. It's a type of guided meditation. So there really isn't a huge distinction, except in yoga nidra, you're lying down and telling yourself not to go to sleep. But it's a wonderful practice. I mean, it's not only a process, but it's a state of consciousness. And there are levels of yoga nidra, which is, it can be used for people who are exhausted and just need to sleep. And maybe they do fall asleep in yoga nidra, and in that case, it's a great thing. And then there's entering into the subconscious mind, which is goes a little deeper, and then there's really dropping down into the unconscious and kind of rooting around and seeing what's stuck in there. It's the territory of the samskaras, the impressions, the yep. imprints that are pasted in our koshas as a result of everything we think and do and say, and you know, and so it's a great practice, and I think it's a good way for people who have trouble sitting or maybe beginning meditation to be introduced to the process.
You've said about your pranayama class, more or less you've said, I'm riffing, but pranayama, breath, breathing with control, is brain food. Why is that?
I said that?
Yeah.
It doesn't sound like something I would say, but I believe you. My students tell me all the time I say things, and I go to them. I say, I never said that. Is it brain food? Well, you know, pranayama continues the work that we start in asana, only it's a little more subtle. It's still teaching us to pay attention. It mm-hmm. can regulate the autonomic nervous system. It brings, you know, greater prana. I mean, let's look at the word pranayama. What does that mean? It means prana, which we could say is energy. It's a little hard to define prana because we don't really, you know, we use words to describe it, but it's just, we don't exactly know what it is. But pranayama, to me, is just managing your energy. And mm-hmm. doing these practices help us pay attention to what we're doing with our energy. What are you plugged into that's draining your reserve? An mm-hmm. argument you had with your sister last week, or some anxiety about the future, or some regret about something you did, you know, a month ago, or, you know, there's always that subterranean activity in the brain that is just never takes a break. And so, again, pranayama is teaching us to get our attention in present time in a little more subtle way than asana. It's going a little deeper. Now you're working on the prana kosha, the prana field. Asana kind of works on the food body, on the food field. So I think in that sense, it's cleansing the, you know, in order for the prana to travel unrestricted on the nadis, which is the tracks that prana travels on, it requires asana to clear them off and so that the trains don't derail when you start running the practices. And mm-hmm. then my teacher always used to say pranayama, and this is very technical, but pranayama is not only not correct, but it's impossible without mulabandha. Pranayama, as well as asana, has to be done in what I call a closed system. In other words, you're locking the first chakra, and then you're running prana so apana doesn't run out. And then it's mm-hmm. effective. Then you're really blasting out the toxins and And then, yeah, is it brain food? Good. It certainly quiets the pond and develops the potential for insight into your life and your reality.
Finally, on the asana parts that you'll be teaching, is that open to all levels? People who hear the word ashtanga, people hear ashtanga and they think, oh my God, I'm old, I have injuries, I have whatever their excuse is, they won't come to your door because they're afraid it's not for them. What's your response to that?
It's first of all, I'm not teaching ashtanga at Telluride, and I rarely teach it now. I teach something called present power sequence. It's a combination of postures from, it is based on my background, it's a combination of some of the primary postures from the first and second series of ashtanga. And it's a great sequence, just as the Ashtanga sequences are, but it's more well-rounded. I mean, a lot of people start out in Ashtanga and they get stuck in primary series, and as brilliant as it is as a sequence, it's not complete. You can't just do primary series. You can, but it's not going to bring a lot of balance into your life. It's primarily forward bending, and it doesn't balance it out with some of the heart opening and backward bending, back therapy that we need. So I just developed this sequence that combines a bunch of the postures that is much more well-rounded and appropriate for as an entry level, as a way to start yoga for people who don't plan on jumping onto the Ashtanga train. And I always say I can teach this sequence to people in a wheelchair, you know, I have, whether you're an amputee or you have any kind of disability. I've taught this to veterans and seniors and not children. Children is not my field of expertise, but yeah, there's always, I'm teaching a course at Kripalu next February in Lenox, Mass., and I was just writing up the course description. I said, do you think you're too tight to do yoga or too busy to meditate? You know, think again, because everybody thinks that, and yet yoga is exactly what you need. You know, there has to be a way to start, which is going all the way back to what we talked about earlier. Why I came up with power yoga is that these athletes needed a way, an entry into yoga. They couldn't just jump into a primary series-led class and escape without injury. So I taught it very much in the Mysore Ashtanga style. The first class of beginning course was just sun salutes, and then you had a few standing postures, and then you had a few more. So, yeah, so all are welcome.
Okay, perfect. Well, thank you very much. This has been Susan Vibrock. Telluride Inside and Out, delighted to once again be speaking with Beryl Bender-Birch. She is returning to Telluride, thank goodness, to teach at the 12th Annual Telluride Yoga Festival that takes place June 27th to June 30th. Beryl, on with your day, and thanks so much for your time.
Susan, thanks so much. This has been great. I look forward to seeing all our listeners in Telluride really soon.
Likewise.